Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring issues facing landlords and tenants, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, lenders, and everyone in the industry. Our style is conversation over coffee with highly experienced and articulate commercial real estate professionals. Howard's legal and commercial real estate practice, over 35 years, has centered on collaborative arbitration, broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio is presented with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our audience. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Welcome to CRE Radio. We have a very interesting show today. The show is posing the question, do your insurance provisions actually protect you in your commercial leases? Or words to that effect. We have our featured guest today would be Ira Meislick from New Jersey. He's an attorney. And David Ezra is also an attorney. And I must make an admission here or disclosure. David is an ex-partner of mine at Berger Kahn. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Howard. This is Ira. Thanks for inviting us.
So let's talk about how this whole idea of this show started. Well, first of all, we will be discussing insurance provisions in leases, but we're going to be talking probably more of a hands-on approach where not only what these insurance provisions mean, what insurance you can get and you can't get, but how it affects the landlords and tenants in perhaps, and I'm misusing the term, typical insurance provisions. And I say that with a great deal of caution. Typical. There must be thousands of different typical insurance provisions. So you got to be careful when I use that term. This show was inspired by one of our guests, Ira Meislick. Ira, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You're remarkably so. Thank you, Howard.
Oh, there you go. And Janice Chisholm? Chisholm and Janice, they both made this presentation at this past year's ICSC Legal Conference in Orlando, and I understand Ira will be being a presenter this coming year in San Diego. They didn't deem mine worthy enough to ask me to come back, but be that as it may, that's why I'm the radio person and I have special guests. In creating this outline for the radio show, I realized, which is typical of me, that the outline that I prepared is far too broad and inclusive to discuss all insurance issues relevant to commercial leases. And you should understand also that there is a much more detailed, or there will be a much more detailed outline that Ira has provided, which we will post on our website. We're intending to focus on and address lease clauses, obviously, and problems that might arise in the course of lease negotiations and the practical application of enforcement, or from my perspective, lack thereof, of the insurance provision. These insurance provisions will often include the insurance clauses, but are not limited to the insurance clauses. We're going to have to look at some point damage and destruction and the termination provisions and what the meaning of fixtures are, which is a recent article written by Ira, who I might add, I was in the midst of writing an article on fixtures, great minds run in the same gutters, when I saw his article, so I have decided to make changes to mine so it sounds significantly different from his. I don't want him to accuse me of copying him. So, let me start with the question. Why do commercial leases typically require the tenant to obtain insurance? And Ira, why don't we start with you?
Well, I want to act somewhat as a successful politician and ask the question that you didn't ask. I'm going to answer the question that I have already in mind.
That's not a politician. That's a lawyer.
And so I want to, for those who haven't heard this from me, I want to recite a mantra. To me, and I'm not alone, All insurance is credit enhancement. So I'll give you an example. If ExxonMobil leases a building to the United States government, ExxonMobil doesn't need property insurance to be able to rebuild the building if it's destroyed. The United States government doesn't need liability insurance to protect itself about going out of business if they're sued, or to provide backup for the United States government's indemnification of ExxonMobil. We call for insurance because we don't trust the parties, the landlord or the tenant, to have enough money on their own to meet their own obligations. So we ask them to find a credit-worthy person called an insurance company to stand behind them. That's why the insurance industry exists, because people want to lay the risk off because they can't bear the risk. So now, more directly to your question, and on the way I will say, the reason a tenant wants its landlord to have insurance, and in this case, in the example, property insurance, is if the building is damaged, the tenant wants to get back into business, and if the landlord really wants to fix the building but doesn't have the money to do so, the tenant's not going to be in business. So the tenant ask the landlord to carry property insurance, as does the landlord's lender.
Ira, let me interrupt you here for a second, because you have stolen my thunder. Because one of the questions that I often get in negotiations, particularly with inexperienced tenants, is that they ask the question, well, if the landlord's providing insurance, why do you want me to have insurance also? And I think this goes to what you were talking about, which is that both parties often are required, hopefully, to provide insurance. But there are different risks involved. Isn't that true?
That's correct. You're stealing my answer, Howard. you're stealing my
My thunder, so there.
Well, yeah. When a landlord insists that its tenant carry property insurance so that the tenant, if it loses its own property, its fixtures, its equipment, its inventory, why would the landlord want the tenant to insure all that property? The landlord's not getting a check from that insurance policy. It's because the landlord doesn't trust that the tenant, after the place is rebuilt, will be able to go back in business, will be able to afford to replace the fixtures and the equipment and the cash registers and the computers and the inventory. So the landlord says, tenant, I want you to carry property insurance on your personal property, not so I get a check from you, but so that after I put the building back together, I still have a tenant. Similarly, the legitimate reason, in my view, for a landlord to insist that its tenant carry liability insurance, that is, if the tenant is sued, is so that the tenant can bear the loss of having to pay somebody and still be in business. The secondary reason, and I think it's not, I'm not an adherent to the secondary reason in a pure sense, is the landlord thinks that it's going to get a bargain or it's going to get much better protection if the tenant is also carrying liability insurance and the landlord somehow gets its name tacked onto the policy. We call that as an additional insured. I consider that to be about fifth in importance on the list, the first being that the tenant be able to get it back into business, and there being no 2, 3, and 4. But we can come back to that. And I know that David, who does a lot of liability insurance disputes, we can probably fill in the gaps as to why Ira is on the right track or not on the right track about whether a landlord should rely primarily on its own insurance policy and a tenant should rely primarily on its own liability insurance policy. And with that, I'll just hand it back to you. I'm going home now.
Well, David, Ira poses an interesting question. Is there a strategic benefit to the landlord or is it just that the landlord can't insure certain things as to why the landlord would require the tenant to provide liability insurance? Or maybe I should pose the question another way. Can the landlord insure the personal property of the tenant?
Well, it's a great question, and from a property insurance standpoint, there's quite a bit of the tenant's property that you know, and you have the fixtures and whatnot that arguably benefit the landlord, and so this concept of insurable interest is the landlord going to be made worse off if there's damage to the tenant's property? Probably in a lot of cases enables the landlord to go out and actually get their own insurance to cover their interests in what could go wrong if the tenant's property is damaged. So that's possible. Economically speaking, you know, most of the clients I've worked with, landlords want the tenants to insure as much as they can. Tenants want the landlords to insure as much as they can. And that's the way that typically goes, with both sides kind of pushing the other to get as much insurance as they can and take on as much of the risk as they can. But there are, I think, working with a good broker, there's probably a lot that if you're the belt and suspenders type, you've got to have that protection. You can probably buy a lot of that for yourself.
Now, you just said something that's going to be a major theme that I'm going to be pressing during this entire show, and that is working with a good broker. Maybe we should have had a good broker on this show also, because, and you'll hear me say this over and over again, while I have a certain degree of expertise with regard to commercial real estate leases, insurance provisions is not my specialty. And as such, I usually defer issues regarding insurance to someone who really knows the insurance provisions and often rely upon competent insurance brokers. So whether you're a landlord or tenant, you really better be talking to someone who can give you a good idea of the risks that you should be paying attention to and protecting. And that'll be a theme, you know, rather than taking this hour to an hour and a half that we're going to be talking about, rather than taking this and going, okay, I'm now fully knowledgeable on the issue of insurance in commercial leases, hopefully we're going to give just enough so that you know that unless you are an expert, you better get one to help you. So, speaking with the experts, I noticed...
Hey, Howard. Yeah. Howard, let me speak as if I were a competent commercial insurance broker. Not every insurance broker is competent in commercial insurance. It is a specialty, not a unique specialty, but there are a lot of misconceptions among, you know, my sister-in-law sells homeowners insurance and certainly can write a commercial policy, but my sister-in-law, I've made that up, by the way. I don't have a sister-in-law. But my sister-in-law really doesn't know about commercial insurance and won't admit it and says things that are just not right. So I concur with you, let's say 300%, that everybody who negotiates a lease and every business person should align themselves with a truly competent commercial real estate broker, and then you'll have the protection you think you're paying for.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that, frankly, that's true in almost any endeavor. Not all attorneys are competent attorneys. Not all attorneys are competent to advise on insurance issues. Dave particularly knows that. If it comes to insurance, I simply pick up the phone and call Dave. I don't even come close to even talking about it. I just train myself to see the issue and then pick up the phone. That's it. I'm not competent to testify or to give advice on the issue.
And let me say this, Howard. This is Dave, of course. And as someone who's been fighting about insurance disputes and worrying about what does the policy language mean and what's good faith and what isn't good faith and what's covered and what isn't covered for decades, even an attorney that does that for a living day in and day out and you know, spends a considerable amount of time thinking about what is and is not in an insurance policy, what does it mean, what doesn't it mean. I don't spend my time paying attention to the insurance marketplace the way a broker will, so that I know what's available at any given time. And I don't spend a lot of time on the front end thinking about what protection someone might need. I typically come in after there's been something's gone terribly wrong, after the fire, after the lawsuit, after the wrongful death, whatever it happens to be, and then I get involved in cleaning up the mess. Your brokers see things from the front end, and they should be better and specially trained to help you help either landlord or tenant assess what their risks are and where they need to go in the insurance marketplace to get the best protection, so that when their unfortunate calamity, you know, comes out of the blue, that they're in the best position with the best policy language and the best terms to be the best protected. So I would, again, agree with what each of you have said, that for anyone out there who's in the business side, you know, as a landlord, as a tenant, you want to find a good insurance broker that knows your area, that can assess your risks on the front end and help you navigate the insurance market before you have the unfortunate event that causes you to start the claims process.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to take a brief break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about what is typically, I hate using that word, in the landlord's insurance, what's typically in the tenant's insurance. And I want to talk a little bit about perhaps explaining to me what the difference is between liability insurance and casualty insurance, because I've been looking at some of the lease clauses. They make reference to these different types of insurance as if they are different. So why don't we take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll be discussing those issues.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to ProspectNow.com and enter the promotion code Howard.
That's ProspectNow.com.
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's LOGOS, the number 2, then LIFE.com. Logostolife.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio, via email to questions@creradio.com.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio. I was just prompted to let everyone know that if you want to leave a comment, you can leave a comment on Twitter for us. And that's using the little @ CRE Radio, or you can go to our website at creradio.com/insurance. And before we get back to our guests, I also want to mention that there's, for some of you who already know, I'm a bit of a techie, and there is a Real Tech conference up in San Francisco, it's coming up April 30th. And one of my favorite software companies, online software companies, Prospect Now, will be up there. So I highly recommend that you go to our website where you can see reference to the conference and click on that for more information. So, gentlemen, let's get back to our issues regarding what is the typical insurance that landlord's insurance will cover, to the extent we haven't already discussed that.
Yeah, on the landlord side, and Ira can jump in here anytime he wants, but I think most landlords are looking to insure the structure that they're leasing out, what I'd call property insurance. They want to make sure if there's a fire, something, you know, the truck runs into the side of the building, whatever it is, that they've got as much insurance for that as they can, so that somebody can put it back together, or at the very least they can get paid off and pay off their loan. And that's what I would typically call on the property insurance side. And these are the basics. There's a lot of nuances in here. So that's for the physical component. And then there's the liability flip side of the coin. A lot can go wrong when you own property. Someone can fall down the stairs and file a lawsuit against you. A shingle can fall off your roof and it can hurt somebody. There's a million things that can go wrong that can result in a lawsuit. And so you want the liability insurance, which typically says, in its most basic form, if you do something that causes an injury to somebody else's, someone else physically is hurt or their property is damaged, they sustain a bodily injury or they unfortunately die as a result of something you're doing or some condition of your property, you can look to your liability insurance company to defend that lawsuit and protect you either with a settlement or maybe indemnifying a judgment if you can't resolve the case and don't win at trial. So those would be two very basic flavors, the property side and the liability side. And then it gets more nuanced as you try to protect income streams and the like that you might have an advantage from the property you own and the leases you have in place and so on. And I think maybe Ira would like to speak to some of the more nuanced coverages that are out there.
Well, let me ask this question first. If the landlord and tenant both have liability insurance, is the tenant's liability insurance limited to events that occur within the physical limitations of the tenant's premises? And is the landlord's liability insurance limited to events that occur in the common areas or places outside of the tenant's premises? Or is it typically both covering both aspects of the property? If you can, Ira, why don't you answer that?
Yeah, Howard, let me jump in. First, terminology. The modern terminology in the context we're talking about is property insurance, as opposed to casualty or marine coverage. Today, we call generally the industry calls it property insurance, and the liability side is called liability insurance, and the form of policy is commercial general liability policy, not public liability, not comprehensive liability. The term is commercial general liability insurance policies. That's liability, and property insurance or property insurance policies. There are other kinds of insurance, as you know. There's, you know, health and life. We're not talking about those. And there are subsets of property policies and of liability policies. By example, well, an automobile insurance policy is fundamentally a liability insurance policy. It is a separate risk that's being insured from somebody who might have somebody fall in the store or slip on the sidewalk. As to your question, liability insurance covers acts and people who do the acts, not properties. So a liability policy that you might carry would say that if that you do something that hurts somebody else and need to compensate that person, we, the insurance company, will give you the money to do so. I think David generally, without some of the nuance, a liability insurance policy is a policy of indemnity. It will pay when you have to pay somebody else for an act that the policy covered, for your negligence. You're negligent, you harm somebody, you owe them money, you've paid an insurance company to take that risk. That's liability insurance. Property insurance is your own property is destroyed. You've paid somebody to take the risk of that loss, and they give you the money for it. The way most people would understand this is most people have automobile insurance, and they know that part of their automobile insurance is collision insurance. They have liability. If they're in an accident, their insurance company will pay for the damage that they cause, but their collision policy will pay for damage to their car even if they weren't in the car at the time. So when we talk about liability between the insured and its insurance company, the scope of the policy says what they'll cover. So by way of simple example, you may have a liability policy that covers any negligent act that you cause, except it'll be a geographic limitation. They'll only insure you if you did it in the United States. That's between you and the insurance company. The tenant in your concern will have a liability insurance policy. The tenant doesn't want a policy that only covers acts within the four walls. The tenant wants a liability policy that might cover it if a product it sells explodes in somebody's home. Or the tenant might want a liability insurance policy if its employee goes out to install something in somebody's home and breaks the sink. So the liability policy per se is not geographically limited. What can be geographically limited is the relationship between the landlord and its tenant. The landlord may say, we want you, the tenant, to indemnify us or to make sure that your insurance coverage includes any risk we may have that occurs on the property, that occurs in your premises, it occurs in your restroom, whatever the agreement is. And then with respect to the landlord being covered under the tenant's policy, generally speaking, the insurance that the landlord gets, you know, as a beneficiary of its or an additional insurer under its tenant's policy is limited to the agreement that the landlord and tenant have privately made. The landlord and tenant can't get more coverage from the insurance company than the policy holds, but the landlord and tenant can cabinet, as between the two of them, what the tenant's insurance policy will protect the landlord against, or what the landlord's insurance policy will protect the tenant against. I know that, David, if we were sitting here talking more technically, the question as to whether that's strictly true is something that David makes a living out of. But I think in general, David, would you agree with me, or should I just pretend my phone went dead and you lost me for the rest of the call?
No, I actually do agree with that. In general, the policies won't be what restricts the coverage. Every once in a while you get a policy that has an endorsement or is written in a way that'll confine the coverage a little bit more, maybe a designated premises type limitation or something like that. But what you end up with is in the negotiations in a lease, or this happens in indemnity agreements too, and in other contexts, you might have the landlord and tenant trying to decide in advance whose insurance will cover based on where an event occurs, and that can give rise to a lot of disputes. If someone is in the ice cream shop and they step on some ice cream and then they walk out into the common area and that's when they slip and fall, did that injury arise from the common area or from the leased ice cream shop? Those kinds of things become significant debates, and it's an interplay between the agreement that the landlord and tenant have, and then you're looking at additional insured issues overlaying that, and those can be very challenging situations. But by and large, yeah, the insurance policies themselves not so confined. They rarely say you're only covered for this space or that space.
Well, Dave, your example of the ice cream on the shoe from the ice cream shop, I think is a perfect segue, correct me if I'm wrong, to the issue of the waiver of subrogation. I was going to talk about that much later on, because I know very few landlords or tenants who have any clue what a waiver of subrogation provision is. But isn't the waiver of subrogation provision there for the purpose of avoiding that significant dispute as to where the injury actually occurred?
Howard, you're touching on what I would say is the number one misunderstood issue in insurance as attorneys or other negotiators deal with a lease or any other contract. Waiver of subrogation is an agreement between an insured and its insurance company. It is not an agreement between the two parties to the lease or other contract. Let me repeat that. A landlord doesn't give a waiver of subrogation to the tenant, and the tenant doesn't give a waiver of subrogation to the landlord. That's number one. Number two is, while there is some applicability of a waiver of subrogation in liability insurance policies, it is almost remote, but there is some applicability. When people talk about waiver of subrogation, they are talking about property insurance policies. Number three, before I, try to describe or explain what this waiver of subrogation is, I'm circling in on it. The standard, the most common form of property insurance policy is promulgated by the Insurance Services Organization, ISO. It's a trade organization. It's probably the basis, the actual policy or the basis for 95% of the property insurance policies written in America. It contains pre-printed in it a waiver of subrogation in the condition part of the policy if somebody wants to look. Now, what is it? The subrogation, and I'll tell you what, David, I would explain subrogation, but because you do insurance litigation, you're probably able to explain it in a way that people will best understand it. Could you explain subrogation, and then perhaps I'll tell you what, or I'm willing to do it, but David, I suspect that you can say it clearly, and I can say it like a negotiator.
Well, let me say it as clearly as I can. Subrogation is a big fancy word for what's basically a simple concept. Let's just take a simple situation. The tenant has some piece of equipment that's electric. They leave it on. It causes a fire and burns down a big chunk of the landlord's building. And the landlord turns around to his or her insurance company and says, "My building burned down. I need money to rebuild it." And the insurance company says, they look at their policy, they say, "We covered that. Here's a check for $1 million. Rebuild your building." At that point, all else being equal, under principles of subrogation, the insurance company then steps into the landlord's shoes, and they have whatever rights the landlord would have to pursue the negligent tenant whose negligence, if you will, started the fire, and they can pursue the tenant, all else being equal, either in their own name as an insurance company holding rights of subrogation, or they'll do it in the name of the landlord or the party that they paid. So, in general, insurance company that pays a claim, and it's in its simplest form a property insurance loss, can then step into the shoes of their insured, their policyholder, and chase down the parties that caused the loss, that are legally responsible in tort law or whatever basis they have to pursue it. So that is subrogation. You've got the insurance company now taking the place of the party that suffered the loss and pursuing the wrongdoer.
So let me now go ahead, Dave. Howard, go right ahead. It's your show.
No.
I'll take the opening. So, but if you have car insurance, you have a collision policy, and somebody hits your car, your insurance company gives you a check, and they sue the person that hit your car. Okay? So what David has described is the tenant caused the fire. It damaged the landlord's property. The insurance company gave the landlord the money, and now the insurance company wants to step in the shoes of the landlord, who has a tort claim against a tenant or a contract claim, usually a tort claim against a tenant who started the fire. But the tenant and the landlord have agreed in their lease to waive those claims against each other. Each has said that if my property, either my personal property or your building, is damaged, right? I'm not going to chase you even if you caused it. I will only look to my insurance company. I'm not going to chase you. Landlord, if I caused the fire, and since I'm the tenant, I'm probably the one that caused the fire. If not me, it was another tenant. But I caused the fire. Landlord, you have insurance. Look to your insurance company. Don't come to me. The landlord is being asked to give away a valuable right that the insurance company has, the right that the insurance company could go after the tenant. But the marketplace has priced that risk into the premium. The insurance companies already charge a premium that will allow their landlord or their tenant to give away that right. And it's not because they just priced it in, it's a little extra profit. It's because they will probably tell you, case law all over the country says, the judges say, hey, look, we're not stupid. I know it's the landlord's insurance policy, but we know who's really paying the premium. It's the tenant, and vice versa. Now,
well, before
that's
you
why
go
it's preprint in the policy.
Hold that thought. We've got to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about this because I've got a whole bunch of questions, such as additional indemnity provisions in leases that are referenced in the waiver of subrogation clauses, and what happens when one of the parties doesn't provide insurance or doesn't provide adequate insurance to cover the loss. So we're going to get back to those issues as soon as we get back from those messages.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today.
Okay, and this is Howard. I do want to mention something here. While we do have a very close relationship with the National Retail Tenants Association, which, by the way, is no longer limited to retail representation by lease administrators for tenants. They also do office now. We have also recently started a new relationship with IREM, the Institute of Real Estate Management. And one of the things I'd like to mention is these are two organizations that I really, really support. They are both wonderful organizations, one representing the tenant and one representing the landlord. IREM representing the landlord. Highly educational, highly professional, and probably within our next show, you'll have the opportunity to hear a special presentation for IREM. Okay, Ira, did you remember that thought that I so rudely interrupted you?
I remembered the thought, but I didn't understand the question. I didn't understand the question.
I don't even remember.
We were talking about waivers of subrogation. We were talking about waivers of subrogation, and so each party says in their agreement that they won't chase the other party if, you know, I won't chase you if my property is destroyed, you won't chase me if your property is destroyed. Then you look at the insurance policy, and the insurance policy has a waiver of subrogation which says that even though you gave away our right to chase the person, who, you know, your tenant or your landlord, we'll still honor the policy. The waiver of subrogation and insurance policy is an agreement by the insurance company that the policy will remain in force even if you give away the insurance company's right to chase the tenant or the landlord. And to put a nail in the coffin, the standard provision says that we, the insurance company, will let you waive this right in a written contract before the fire or the other event. And if you're a landlord, you can even waive it with an agreement with the tenant after the fire. Yes, the policy says that even if you had the right to chase the tenant because it burned down your building, if you, even after the fire, landlord, agree that the tenant doesn't have to pay you for it, we, the insurance company, will still honor the insurance. That's because all around the country in case law, the insurance companies got beat up, so they priced the risk in the policy. What you said after that, Howard, let me say, I don't remember, but if I remembered it, I didn't understand it.
Yeah, I'm going to get younger guests from now on, you know. Yeah. This forgetting stuff. Well, I already forgot the question that I first asked you. So, but
why would younger guests want to hang around with an old guy like you?
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
Is this going to be war?
Yes.
Oh, that's because I'm cool and I have tech gadgets, although perhaps the president doesn't consider himself or his kids don't consider him cool. Actually, neither do mine. So let me get
and
back
great,
to...
And great theme music.
Yeah, there you go. I don't think anybody thinks that my theme music is cool. Okay, so here we're talking about the waiver of subrogation, but doesn't the landlord waive... doesn't he waive the right to subrogation with the understanding and belief that the tenant is going to have insurance covering the risk, or does it really make any difference?
The landlord releases the tenant from liability for damage to the landlord's policy. The tenant releases the landlord for liability for damage to the tenant's policy. The insurance company says, we don't care. It's all right for you guys to waive that, to waive those claims. We're not counting on chasing either of you if there's a fire. We have a pile of money. You paid us to reach into our pile of money and cover your loss. The waiver is in the insurance policy. It's between the insured and its insurance company. As between the two parties, they release each other from liability.
Is it possible that an insurance company may not agree to a waiver of subrogation?
Well, you know, it's possible, but as I point out, in the dominant insurance policy, you have to erase it. And I'm not aware of, and I've looked at them all, I'm not aware of any endorsements, any pre-printed endorsements that remove that. Further, at this point, David's going to have to back me up, and I hope that he will.
Oh, don't,
there's
David,
case
please.
Law, there's case law all around the country where the courts have said that in a landlord's property policy, its tenant is a third-party beneficiary of that policy, and therefore the insurance company cannot chase a third-party beneficiary because it's as if it was one of its insureds. In some markets, like in the automobile collision market, that's not the case because the person who hit your car at random had no relationship with you before they hit you. But, you know, whether it's in the rent or the tenant is paying separately its share of insurance, it's really the one paying the insurance. It's really the beneficiary of the policy at the end of the day. And case law all over the country says, insurance companies don't waste your time with us, and so the insurance companies just gave in and raised the premium. Gave in and raised the premium is my analysis. You won't find that document of admission by the insurance companies. David, are you familiar with that litigation, which is why this whole discussion that we have when we negotiate leases with people who are not familiar with waivers of subrogation just goes nowhere?
It's increasingly common that the parties can landlord-tenant can waive the right to chase each other without voiding the policy. So if you were stopped at a stoplight and got rear-ended, somebody bashed your car up, and you turned around, you got out of the car and said, "Hey, the good news is I've got insurance for this, so I'll release you right now." And then you drove home and called the claim into your insurance company. They'd have a real problem with that, right? They've got a right of subrogation, and by releasing the party that hit you, you've just given that away. And as Ira points out, in the context of leasing, we typically don't expect that to be the case. I'm nervous. Not all policies are issued on standard forms. You want to think about that as you're drafting your leases and whatnot. For some people, it's an easy way to do it is to say, to the extent allowed by the policy, we waive the right to chase. Now, the subrogation right really belongs to the insurance company, but if you give up the right to pursue recovery from the at-fault third party, then the subrogation right is not exercisable. It has no value. That's been given up. So I think Ira pointed out earlier, subrogation really belongs to the insurance company, not the landlord or the tenant. But in their context, they can waive the right to chase each other, which simplifies their lives. And there's another element to this, which is, you know, if you think about it, it's going to average out in the end. If the insurance company that provides the property insurance pays for the fire loss, and then they look at the lease and they say, gosh, the landlord gave up the right to chase the tenant, well, that means the tenant's liability insurance is not going to have to kick in and pay that claim. Heck, in some cases, it'll be the same company on both sides of the transaction anyway. But overall, it's going to balance out and average out. So I tend to agree with Ira that this is it's the trend. It's what I think makes good business sense for landlords and tenants. That why do they want to involve themselves in more protracted litigation if they say, hey, that when somebody's got insurance, we won't, the insurance company pays and we won't chase each other. To the extent they can do that, I think they're better off for it.
Hey, Ira, can I insert a comment?
Sure, so. Howard, please.
Well, I have two comments, actually. One of which, based upon what Dave has just said, it probably would make sense that as part of the waiver of subrogation provision, there's language in there that says that where each party is required, wherever they're required to provide insurance, there should be an endorsement in each policy where the insurance company agrees to the waiver of subrogation just in case it's not included as standard language already. Go ahead.
Howard, I have to say no.
Okay.
For a couple of things. One is,
I finally got you to disagree.
Well, the number of leases that I have done ends in the word thousands. Right? I have never yet had a lease where a waiver of subrogation was not obtainable and obtained. It is pre-printed in a standard policy, and the provision should say that each party will, have a policy that allows for the waiver of subrogation.
Yeah.
The period, not that if you have it, you'll get it and so forth. And by the way, I mean, the reason that the tenant wants the landlord's policy to have a waiver of subrogation is because the tenant wants the landlord to get a check to put up the building. And if there were no waiver of subrogation and the tenant had caused the fire and the insurance company doesn't write the check, the building doesn't go up. See, the release is effective. I release you, you release me. That's effective. The reason you want a waiver of subrogation is because I want, in the first place, you to have insurance on your building so you can rebuild it. The landlord wants the tenant to have insurance so it can get new fixtures and get back into business. There was a question in what David had to say. And the question was, as he said, that if the tenant caused the fire, then and could be sued by the landlord, which means then the insurance company, stepping in the shoes of the landlord, will conduct that suit for recovery. The tenant would be looking for liability coverage to write the check for the damage it caused. The subject of this, the global subject of this program, is how extensive are these insurance policies. Thus, a liability insurance policy, a commercial general liability policy without further endorsement, doesn't cover that risk beyond, I think, $50,000. The policy, the commercial general liability policy has a dollar limitation, a cap on what the liability company will pay for property that's in your care, custody, or control. You need what is commonly called, it's misnamed, but it's commonly called, you need an endorsement for fire legal liability. And if a tenant went out to get an endorsement to its liability insurance company to protect it, should it have to pay for the whole building, it in effect is buying a property insurance policy. It costs the same as a property insurance policy. I have a $50,000 policy. It covers my customer's equipment that's on my shelf. Maybe it's a retail store, or somebody brought their toaster in to be fixed and it's destroyed in the fire and they sue me for their toaster. I've got $50,000 coverage for that. I can take it to $100, $150, but if I want to cover a $4 million or a $20 million building, I'm buying my own property insurance policy. And I'm already paying for a property insurance policy pro rata on my space. So don't expect if a tenant exposes itself for the landlord or the landlord's insurance company to come back against the tenant when the tenant caused the fire, the tenant thinks its liability insurance policy will cover it. That's wrong.
Ira, I need to interrupt you because I got to wrap up this conversation on subrogation, because it's kind of taken over. I think it's a very important conversation. My experience with waiver of subrogation clauses goes back to the 70s and 80s, particularly during a time where I was in-house counsel for a tenant, and we had leases all over the country. And
was that the 1870s or the 1970s?
Oh, here we go. I'm not that old. It was the 1770s, actually. And I used to wear one of those three-cornered hats. Okay, so going back to some of this stuff, I can recall the first time we actually had a waiver of subrogation provision, and we had to go back to our insurer who covered all of the properties that we were tenants, and we had to ask them for permission. You know, to say, you know, they wanted to review the lease and they had a problem with the waiver of subrogation provision. Is this obviously newer than the last 200 years, as Dave would say, with regard to waiver of subrogation? And then I think there's a very important question, because this really relates to what my understanding was. Is there a situation in which the parties wouldn't want or wouldn't require a waiver of subrogation? So, Dave, how long is it typical that insurance companies would agree to provide coverage and allow a waiver of subrogation?
Well, it's a great question. I haven't studied the history of it, and in many contexts, they don't allow an advance waiver of their rights, but as Ira's pointed out, in many contexts they do, and where you've got leasing provisions and whatnot, you probably are not going to run into a problem having released the right to chase the tenant, if they cause damage, which is good. And I can't tell you, Howard, whether that was exactly when that came into being, but I do think that's certainly the trend. And I think your other question was, are there times when you you don't want to, and to waive your right of recovery. And one of the easy times is when there's, you know, if you don't, you might not have enough insurance on your end. And so, a possible way to do these things that provides a little extra protection is you'll waive the right to recover to the extent you've been paid by an insurance company. But if your loss exceeds the amount the insurance company will pay, then you're retaining the right to pursue the unreimbursed damages, and that can be done as a matter of contract too. So there's some nuances in there, definitely, and something that people ought to be looking at least thinking about, because they want to both protect themselves and I think in general, although I do see some situations where the landlord and tenant but just want to get everything that they can for their own benefit, I think in general, making that calamity really some insurance company's problem as opposed to a fight to the death between the landlord and tenant is probably desirous for both the landlord and tenant.
Absolutely. What about a situation in which one of the parties is self-insured?
Well, Howard, the reason that we call it self-insured as opposed to going naked is because they've decided to invest their money internally rather than give it to an insurance company to invest it for the insurance company's benefit. They've decided to insure, and when somebody says that I'm going to insure or take the risk myself, then the other party should be in no worse position than had the insurance been bought in the first place. What are you saying? Like, I'm not going to buy insurance because I'm going to make you the co-party, the person on the other side of the deal. I'm going to make you my insurance company. I'm going to try to tag into your liability insurance policy, which I'll now require you to carry fire legal liability. Essentially, I require you to carry the property insurance so that if you cause the fire, I'll be able to rely on you as if you were the insurance company. The relationship is pretty simple. The marketplace has a relationship. Landlords buy property insurance, control the property insurance, allocate the cost to their tenants, either built into the rent or by way of cost recovery. Tenants insure their own property. That's the marketplace. And if you decide that you have enough money in the bank to take the risk yourself, the other party said, look, as long as I'm not affected by the fact that you chose not to give your money to an insurance company, I don't care what you do. You look pretty good to me. You're ExxonMobil. I'm pretty sure you could rebuild this building, and that's fine with me. But just because you can rebuild the building with your own money, don't make me into your secondary insurance policy. I want the same place would be as if you bought insurance, and that's the way the deals work out. Among people who can have a discussion, you know, if it's a take or the leave it, then your whole radio show is not useful to those people.
Well, okay.
But when there's bargaining...
Let's not talk about how useful my radio show is.
Okay. No. Your radio show, don't get it, is useful, but not the people who can't use the information they get.
I had this triggering event because at one point I was in-house counsel for a supermarket chain. We owned our own properties, and the properties were self-insured, or we were self-insured. All right. In those instances, I started looking at subrogation provisions, and I said, well, okay, what if the tenant was self-insured? Do we still require insurance? What's the language that we should have? And if they're self-insured, do we waive subrogation? The tenant is not, is everybody going to agree to a waiver of subrogation if one of the parties is self-insured? And the conclusion often was, no, you don't need a waiver of subrogation, or you don't want it.
Howard, I didn't make it clear. You don't waive subrogation. You release your claims. You agree you won't make a claim against the tenant and vice versa. That's not a waiver of subrogation. waiver of subrogation is that the person who's relying on stepping into your shoes has said it's okay if you give up the claim. A landlord doesn't waive subrogation against its tenant and vice versa. So if you own these properties and you have some tenants on it and everybody's self-insured, then whether you require them to get a waiver of subrogation in their insurance policy or not doesn't matter. They don't have an insurance policy. Keep in mind that the agreement that allows a waiver of subrogation is in the insurance policy, not in the lease.
But in a self-insured situation.
There's no third party that's looking to step into your shoes and take over your claim. So you haven't given away anybody else's rights but your own. You haven't given away anybody's subrogation rights. You haven't thwarted their ability to subrogate to your claim. You've given up your own claim. In a lease, you need to do two things. The parties need to release their claims against each other for damage to the releasor's property, and you need to require the other party to make sure their insurance policy remains in force even though they gave up their claim. And the waiver of subrogation is my policy remains in force even though I gave up my claims against you.
So forget about the waiver of subrogation. That really is almost irrelevant right now. If you have
claims is the subject.
Right. And if you have a tenant who is self-insured, you merely have to satisfy yourself that they have adequate assets to cover a claim. Just like they would if they had an insurance policy.
And Howard, let me jump in for a second. This is
sure.
Dave, and I have a little bit different perspective than Ira on this one issue. I wouldn't treat a business or another landlord, tenant, whoever it might be that has significant financial resources as necessarily just as good as if they had insurance. And my reasoning is this. If there's an insurance policy, you get an insurance claims adjuster who isn't emotionally invested in the outcome, typically doesn't have much of an axe to grind. They go home at night, they worry about other stuff. I personally, if I'm on the end of the loss that needs to have the thing paid, I think I'd rather typically be dealing with that dispassionate, unemotional claims adjuster making the decision as to whether or not to write a check. Certainly in any contentious situation where it might not be perfectly obvious as to where the responsibility lies, instead of negotiating with the party that I'm saying is at fault or who should be bearing the loss and those kinds of things. So I do think even a party that has an abundant and unlimited almost ability to pay, I don't want to deal with someone who's headstrong and fighting me in lieu of an insurance company that may be able to step back and look at things a little more clinically and get the job done. That doesn't always happen. It's not always the case. But in general, it's one more reason why, all else being equal, I'd probably rather have an insurance policy that my client can look to.
I fully understand that, David, and I wouldn't disagree with you if that's the case. Often, and most often, companies that have organized plans of self-insurance, they have outside administrators. This could take us into a subject that where Howard won't want to go. So if you have a large company that doesn't insure these risks and you get them to insure the risk, you find out that their policy has an SIR, a self-insured retention, of $2 million or $5 million, and no insurance company is stepping in until the claim passes $2 million or $5 million, and you're in the same situation. But those companies have professional administrators. I know you deal with them, but that's like the tail of the tail of the tail.
You're not wrong.
But it gets you into a place where there's no end to it, and if you have somebody with a company with a $5 billion net worth, they're not agreeing to carry insurance. And that's the end of the story.
Ira,
that's what happens down in the pits.
Okay, let me tell you what happens in the pits, because I have been general counsel when I was general counsel of Big Bear Markets in 1980. We were self-insured. And I can tell, you know, we were self-insured, and really most of the claims had nothing to do with landlord-tenant matters. The insurance covered for the most part, or our self-insurance, was for the purpose of handling all the slip and fall claims. And I will tell you, although we had an administrator handle it, the administrator would often communicate with me. And the attitude within the company was, we are going to pay a lot more closer attention to the viability of these claims than an insurance company on their own. And exactly what Dave is saying is exactly the attitude that we took internally. We paid a lot more attention. We didn't just pay out a claim if we knew that somebody slipped and fell, if we did, you know, sweep reports and stuff like that. So we didn't pay out that much. And let me add one additional thing. My understanding is where there's self-insurance, there's almost always an umbrella policy, or two, or three. It's just a matter of sharing the risk, and I looked at self-insurance as almost nothing more than a deductible, the equivalent of a deductible. We have liability up to X amount of dollars, and somebody made the determination within the business that it would be cheaper to handle claims and to handle insurance in that fashion than just farming it out to a third-party insurance carrier.
Well, so that any insurance professional that's listening to this show doesn't commit suicide upon hearing this show, we're mixing a number of concepts. If we're talking about waiver of subrogation and giving up those claims, let's not talk about liability coverage. We're talking property damage. If you're talking about the situation where a tenant agrees to essentially add its landlord as an additional insured on the tenant's liability policy, so that if somebody falls on a banana peel in the store and they sue the tenant and the landlord, the tenant directly or its insurance company is going to handle the suit and pay the claim. And to the landlord, it really doesn't matter whether the tenant is self-administering and playing hard nose, or whether the tenant's insurance company is writing out checks like handing out, you know, candies. All the landlord cares, at the end of the day, the claim is paid. It doesn't care how much of a hard time that customer was given along the way. So we're not talking waiver of subrogation and liability insurance. Let's not put them in the same discussion. And when we're talking about hard-nosed claim adjusters, right, we're talking about liability, slip and fall, and that kind of thing, where the person who's secondarily covered doesn't care as long as at the end of the day a check is written. When it comes to property insurance, the dispute is between the company, between the person whose property was damaged and its own insurance company. If the company whose property was damaged self-insures, it doesn't have to negotiate with an internal administrator. It has suffered the loss, and it doesn't write itself a check. It just suffered the loss. What the landlord doesn't care how much of a hard time the tenant gets has with its insurance company and having its insurance company pay for the tenant's inventory. And the tenant doesn't care how much of a hard time the landlord has with its insurance company getting insurance for the building. It would prefer that the landlord was self-insured as long as the landlord had sufficient credit, because the landlord doesn't have to go through adjusters and negotiators. It bears the loss. It writes the check. So the what is being said about self-insurance and the companies being stingy in paying out the claims when they're self-insured has nothing to do with waiver of subrogation. And when the companies are covering, self-insuring their own losses, They're not stingy. They already bore the loss. So I think that any competent commercial insurance professional listening to the show, you know, hearing this, will probably dial in next week.
Okay, we've got to move on from this topic. We're going to need to take a break, after which we're going to be talking about, you know, what are, you know, what is the type of insurance that the landlord perhaps typically overlooks and should require. Actually, we're going to look at that, and then we're going to talk more about what the parties typically fail to do after the lease is signed, and in particular, whether or not, to what extent, a certificate of insurance, what value that has, and to what extent being an additional insured, what value that has to any of the parties. And I hate to raise it, particularly in light of a subrogation provision or a waiver of subrogation provision, which perhaps shouldn't make any difference since the landlord and tenant aren't agreeing between themselves to waive subrogation. Okay, we'll be back in a moment.
Do more business with your biggest clients. Techniques Marketing has perfected exciting new ways to increase your revenue with all your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. Look, if you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, let's talk. Visit TechniquesMarketing.com. T-E-C-H, that's the tech. N-I-Q-U-E-S, there you've got your Neeks. TechniquesMarketing.com.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to prospectnow.com and enter the promotion code Howard.
That's prospectnow.com.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio. We are talking with Ira Meislick and David Ezra. Now, I've got to mention something here. First time I ever had any type of discussion with Ira, he felt it necessary to correct me. Actually, I think it was on a statute of frauds issue. So I like having Ira on the show because he's very experienced, he's very knowledgeable, and I hate to admit it, at times and in certain situations, he's much more knowledgeable than me. But I'm not sure that I agree with his entire approach on this waiver of subrogation, but I'm not going to allow him to throw in another comment right now, because we have to move on. So we don't have a lot of time left. I'd like to end the show within another 15 minutes. We may have a part two, in which case I'm going to do a little bit more research, Ira. One of the things that I would like to talk about is what are, in particular, property managers and conversely, what lease administrators are not really doing, notwithstanding the language in the lease. And a lot of that, I know that property managers, because as in Dave's case, I have to handle a lot of cleanup, they don't pay attention to insurance as much as they should. I don't understand why it's so difficult, but they don't verify whether or not the tenant provides the insurance. They don't look at the insurance policies. They don't even wait to see if they get a certificate of insurance. These certificates of insurance, are they of any value?
Well, let me tell you, the answer is no.
Okay.
Now, 95% no. They're a snapshot of what existed at the time that the certificate was prepared. I have nothing else to add.
Well, isn't there usually a provision that in the certificate of insurance that the landlord will be notified if there are any changes to the insurance, et cetera?
They're usually not that good. The certificates actually tend to say that they don't modify the policy. Many times they'll talk about that the certificate holder will be notified, that the insurance company will endeavor to notify the certificate holder of a cancellation of the policy or something like that. But no one would, I would never tell somebody to go ahead and just rely on a certificate of insurance. If what the policy actually says and whether or not there's a policy actually there, you don't want to rely on a certificate of insurance.
Well, typically, in my experience, one, property managers tend not to even get certificates of insurance. They don't tend to follow up to make sure that they've gotten a certificate of insurance, but their thought process is at the very most, that's all that they need. And what you're saying is, gosh, guys, you should follow up and find out whether or not the tenant is providing adequate insurance and don't rely upon a certificate of insurance.
Well, Howard, over the last 7 years, there's been a dramatic change in certificates of insurance. At one time, the current certificate says that this is not a contract. It does not modify the policy. Essentially, anybody reading this cannot rely on it. And to the extent that they talk anything about notice, we'll endeavor to give you a notice, but you've got no claims against us if we don't give you a notice. There's a pre-printed form. It comes out of ACORD, A-C-O-R-D, another insurance industry organization. Those certificates used to say something different. They gave more courage, and they used to be amendable. You could cross things out, you could write on them, and perhaps you could rely on them. Over the last 7 years, the insurance industry has been very successful in going to insurance commissioners and legislatures throughout the United States, now north of 40 states, do not permit any changes to this certificate. And so the certificate you get says you cannot rely on this, this doesn't change the contract, and if we're promising to give you a notice, we're only endeavoring to give you a notice. You might have a claim if they told you that at 4:27 p.m. on April 26, there was this policy. David said something important. So even if they tell you we have this policy, you have no idea what that policy says. And even if you thought you knew what the policy says, you have no idea what endorsements are attached to the policy that take away coverage. The bottom line is that if you're relying on being an additional insured on the other side's liability insurance policy, then you're making a big mistake. If you want liability coverage, carry it yourself. If you want property insurance coverage for your property, carry it yourself. Don't be a landlord who leases an entire building to a tenant, says to the tenant, you carry the insurance, name us as a loss payee on the policy, and we'll be happy. If you own a building, you should carry the property insurance on the building, and if the tenant's going to pay you, let the tenant send you a check for the premium. If you want coverage for an accident that you're sued for, carry your own policy. If you get additional benefit from being named as an additional insured on somebody else's policy, that's fine and dandy. There are circumstances when the other person wasn't at fault and you don't have any insurance. There are circumstances where they forgot to buy the insurance, bought the wrong insurance, or whatever, and you don't have the coverage you have, relying on your own insurance. If you're a landlord, you'll have your own insurance. The tenant's paying you for that insurance anyway, and you've said, and name me as an additional insurer in your policy, and vice versa. It's difficult to explain what the benefits are of being an additional insured because there's a lot of litigation about that, and David can probably tell you very much about whether you have enough protection merely being an additional insured on somebody else's policy.
Well, what's the difference between a loss payee and an additional insured, and does it make any difference to either of the parties?
Well, sure, a loss payee has to do with property insurance, and an additional insured is liability insurance.
Okay. Let's try that again, and then I want David to pipe in on this. Sorry, David.
Let me jump in for 2 seconds. As Iris said, the loss payee or the loss payable provision typically is going to come into play when the property insurance has been invoked and a payment's going to be made, and now the checks will be cut maybe to a loss payee according to their interest in the property. But that's on the property insurance side. An additional insured, when we talk about that, we're typically referring to the liability insurance on a policy. So we get back to our example of the ice cream shop, and now some customer has slipped and fallen and injured themselves severely. They sue the ice cream shop and tenant, and they sue the landlord for the whole mall where they walked out and fell in the common area. And as an additional insured under the tenant's policy, the landlord will want the tenant's liability insurer to defend the landlord and the tenant ice cream shop owner and to pay to settle that case or indemnify a judgment. That's to protect them against the third party. So that's what we're typically talking about as an additional insured. You get the benefit of protection under the tenant's policy in this case for injuries that arise out of the tenant's conduct, if you will, just to put a big simplification on it.
Well, if everybody's providing insurance, what difference is it? Why do you need that language?
Well, if you've got your own liability insurance, you may not actually need it from the standpoint of you're not going to be bare without it. But typically, from a claims experience and whatnot, I think where you can negotiate to be an additional insured on someone else's policy, and you think it's also fairer sometimes if it was their conduct that created the risk that you would get sued. A lot of people would argue that it really ought to be their insurance policy, that pays for your defense and settles the case. And when the year comes around and someone's premiums ought to be increased, maybe it's fairer that that tenant who caused the accident, if you will, their premiums go up and yours don't, because you were able to be, as landlord, you were the additional insured on their policy.
Okay, so using the language additional insured is appropriate. The problem that you have, and I think it's the greatest problem, now, let me go back a second. Ira says that the best way to protect the landlord's interest is to have your own policy and not rely upon the tenant to provide insurance. And I certainly would agree if you're looking to protect yourself. That perhaps is a situation, well, Ira, you used an example that was a single tenant. How does that apply where there are multiple tenants, such as in an office building, multiple tenant office building, or in the situation of a shopping center versus a standalone pad?
Well, I use the example, look, if there's a multi-tenant property, there's no one else to carry the insurance logically than the property owner itself. And therefore, the property owner doesn't even think about the possibility of riding on somebody else's policy. So I use the example about, and it's not uncommon, where somebody owns a property and they lease the whole property to a tenant and they themselves go and retire in Arizona and they expect to get a rent check and leave all the problems to the tenant, including carrying the insurance. Well, if the tenant forgets to carry the insurance and doesn't have the money to rebuild the building, you have no viable claim against anybody else, and you can kick yourself for not having control of the insurance yourself. Same thing with liability insurance. Even if the tenant liability insurance should have answered, if the tenant didn't carry the insurance, so the tenant had an exclusion in its policy, you're not getting any more coverage than the tenant had, and now you have to pay the claim. So if you're a landlord, carry your own property insurance, carry your own liability insurance. If you think you're going to get some kind of market benefit by tagging on to the tenant's policy of liability insurance, Go ahead and try. Same thing with a tenant. Carry your own insurance. Don't rely on the landlord's insurance to cover your property or to cover your liability claims. If you can be a named additional insured on the landlord's liability policy, more power to you. But the place you're going to look is your own insurance company. And we want to have a discussion about whether policy premiums really go up or not. I don't think it's a worthwhile discussion. But yeah, people can be named additional insured on each other's liability policies. I don't think it gives a lot of benefit. People can argue the other side. I haven't been persuaded, and I've persuaded only a handful of people. But I do know that almost everybody agrees that if you're at risk, carry your own policy. If you can get the other person to pay your premium, more power to you. And in most real estate leasing, the tenants are paying for all the insurance at the property, their own insurance policies and the landlord's insurance policies.
So
I mean, that's the economics. That's how the market prices it.
So this actually, I think part of the importance of this conversation, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there you need to pay attention to the distinction between the various risks that you're covering. If you're talking about liability, if you're talking about property, the real property itself or the building structure or something like that versus the tenant's personal property. Because when you're talking about the tenant's personal property, you're really looking to a separate issue, not the landlord's liability, but you're looking more towards whether or not the tenant will have, or as you say, has the credit or the ability to continue to pay rent in the event of some sort of loss, correct?
That's correct. It's very simple. Suppose the lease requires the tenant to insure its inventory, its goods, its fixtures. And the tenant doesn't insure the goods and fixtures. The landlord has no claim. There's no damage claim.
Right.
You can't sue the tenant and say, give me my $100,000. There's no damage claim. So why does a landlord want the tenant to insure the tenant's own property? Only so that the tenant can come back into business and continue paying the rent. So there's a different interest, liability versus property. The tenant wants the landlord to put the building back up, as does the landlord's lender in many cases, no matter what the mortgage policy says that the landlord, a lot of mortgages that says that landlord, that the lender can take the money, but in most cases they don't because they really want the loan. But it's a common misconception. I want to put a plug in. You know, we do a blog every week. A lot of these insurance topics have been covered in the 100-plus blog entries we have. Waivers of subrogation, deductible versus self-insured retention. What does it mean to be an additional insured? What's the difference between an additional insured and a named additional insured? What is contractual liability insurance? It's not a blog on insurance. It's a blog on real estate, but as you pick the topic, it's intimately related. And that can be found at retailrealestatelaw.com, retailrealestatelaw.com. And we got, you know, a lot of these aberrant thoughts that I've shared with you and with David, I've written them down. And so I can't deny that I've said them.
And I love your reference to aberrant thoughts.
I grant that.
Ira, I love you. That's why you're on the show. Now, what I'd like to do is kind of wrap up the show because we've barely scratched the surface of my outline and all of the things that I wanted to talk about. But there is a little bit of theme. There are some things that we did accomplish in this show. And I think one of the things is we came around full circle and talked about the distinctions between the types of insurance and why people want different types of insurance, why the landlord wants different types of insurance. I really think that we have plenty of fodder here for additional shows and discussions, and we can go on and on. David, what is, of the things that we discuss, what's the key themes, the one or two key points that you think or would like to make sure that we've gotten across in this show as we've discussed, which is different from as we've planned?
Two things that jump out at me, and in terms of the business people that have to make these decisions that are listening, one is what we started with. Get yourself a good, knowledgeable broker who can help you on the front end, and that's just critical. And what we've talked about just highlights the complexity of a lot of these issues. So you want to have that specialist that you can turn to who knows the market, who knows the risks and the issues and what they can do for you. I don't think we can overemphasize. Go out, ask around, find yourself a good broker to help you with these issues. The second thing is, we talked about the property managers, and it doesn't just arise in leasing. It's across the spectrum in business. People that will take a certificate of insurance at face value and assume that because that piece of paper found its way to their desk that it references a real insurance policy that's there and in place and is going to afford coverage. And I can say I've had cases involving certificates where the quote-unquote policyholder walked into their broker's office and picked a blank form up off their desk and filled it out themselves. I've seen countless certificates issued by insurance brokers that are not agents of the insurance company and were supposedly not authorized to issue the certificate. I've seen certificates issued and then policies are never enforced because the premium was never paid. I've seen certificates of insurance that don't reflect changes to the policies where coverage was taken away. People made decisions to get different endorsements that excluded things. It goes on and on and on. One, get a good broker. Two, don't take a certificate of insurance at face value if that policy behind the certificate matters to you. Those would be the two highlights that I would have, Howard, that I think those are things that the business people listening can easily wrap their arms around and remember from what was a long show with a lot of complex issues.
Dave, what if the certificate of insurance is meaningless, and maybe you had said this, I perhaps may have missed it, what is it that you should get if it means something to you that the tenant actually has the policies of insurance that the lease requires?
Yeah, great question. And what I would want, for example, if the certificate mattered to me or my client because it's going to reflect that I'm an additional insured on someone else's policy, I may have a big self-insured retention, but if I can be an additional insured on somebody else's policy, then I can shift that first dollar defense coverage to them. So what I would want to see is the actual endorsement to the policy that names me as an additional insured. Those come in different flavors, or sometimes it's automatic if I have an indemnity agreement with someone and I'm holding a certificate or otherwise, then I am an additional insured. But for that, I need to see the actual policy itself. So those would be what you really want to get is a copy of the policy at the final analysis, and if you can't get that, then you at least want the endorsement, and that's in the additional insured context. There's other contexts, and you can't go wrong getting the actual policy. And if you can get it directly from the insurance company, as opposed to a broker who may or may not be authorized to speak for the insurance company, then better yet, they might view you as a pain and it might be difficult and all of that. But if it's meaningful and it matters to you, you'll put in the extra time and you'll come away with a copy of their actual insurance policy.
Ira, is there ever a situation that you feel you should, one of the parties or both of the parties, should get a copy of the policy?
Well, you don't know what insurance somebody's carrying unless you see the policy and all its endorsements. The endorsements are listed on the first part of the policy on the declaration page. I think it's something that a lot of folks, including business people, don't know. First, I concur with David. If it's important to you and you're relying on it, then you want to follow through. There are businesses who do that for you. Some are subsidiaries of insurance brokerage firms, other insurance consultants. You can hire somebody to monitor the insurance that other people are supposed to carry for you. They follow up on making sure that they see the policies, they read the policies, make sure that the coverage that has been promised you in the contract, that is the lease, actually exists. There are services that do that. There are very few landlords of sufficient size that they can pay somebody with the expertise to do that and keep them busy full time. So if it's important to you and you really are intent to rely on somebody else's insurance policy, really consider engaging a service firm to do that task for you. One thing that you're going to reserve for a later show, and you'll want to invite David back, there is already substantial coverage for a landlord in a tenant's liability policy and for a tenant in the landlord's liability policy, even without being named as an additional insured, and that's the contractual liability coverage, which is pre-printed in the commercial general liability policy and can be modified and taken away by some standard endorsements, but a liability policy without being endorsed away or limited actually provides insurance to back up somebody's indemnity for their tort acts. And this contractual liability coverage, I do have a blog piece on that, but that is a litigator's dream. And I am sure that when David hears a contractual liability claim, he just lights up and says, I can dig my teeth into this. But that is a primary source of coverage under Party B, under Party A's policy, even if the policy doesn't name Party B. David, would you concur, I hope?
It's where you have to go sometimes. It's not the preferred start point, but if you're not an additional insured, and where you can get that for sure first dollar defense, then you are looking at it and saying that, wait a minute, they've got that party is contractually obligated to indemnify me. So there can be coverage for that. In some instances, you can get a defense that way too, but it tends to be a little more discretionary and a little bit more hoops to jump through those circumstances.
It's often wise for the other party's insurance company to provide the defense because they're not obligated to provide defense, but if you incur defense costs yourself and you're being indemnified contractually for those defense costs, then the other insurance company is going to wind up paying them anyway. That's between lawyers and insurance companies and the like, but at the end of the day, it is a substantial overlap with being named an additional insured. There are slight differences, but it is a substantial overlap. It's the indirect way to get what you really wanted to get directly, but it's a pretty good coverage.
Ira, in 1 minute or less, what are the key points that you think that we got across or you would like to make sure that we got across in this show?
Well, not to duplicate what David said, I'm going to suggest that remember that insurance is a credit enhancement. That's why people have insurance or require others to have insurance. And second, if you really want coverage, carry it yourself.
Okay. And in a minute or less, my comment is I basically concur with Dave on this issue. Of course, I'm thinking from the perspective of cleaning up messes that are often arise since, the landlords and property managers don't really check anything having to do with insurance coverage. Certainly don't rely upon a certificate of insurance. If it's a property manager, and I may throw this out to my IRM friends, if you're a property manager and you are requiring the tenant to provide a policy, the actual policy of insurance, don't just take it. I think that you have to either go to the landlord or recommend to the landlord or to have an expert review it. If you simply accept it without doing anything further, you may be accepting liability if something goes wrong on that policy, and I don't think it's appropriate to accept that. And certainly, I have never seen a property manager who is qualified to read an insurance policy. For that matter, I'm not qualified to read an insurance policy. So don't rely upon these things themselves. I'd like to start wrapping up the show. And in doing so, I'd like to ask Ira if you have any appearances or presentations coming up in the near future.
I'm not going to give a list. As you already said, in San Diego in October, we'll all be there with about 1,300 people whose primary focus is retail real estate law. And it's a terrific conference. And if there's anybody in this business who's in the retail business and they're not aware of the International Council of Shopping Centers and all of its programs, let alone, and I'm talking about its annual law conference and other things, then they're really missing out. I know they're not a sponsor of yours, but I will be there. You can see my regular writings. I've got some local speaking, but most of the time try and enjoy our grandchildren.
And Dave, this is not to imply that Ira doesn't do a great job for his clients, because honestly, I absolutely am positive that he does. But other than the wonderful work that I have personally experienced that you do for your clients, do you have any speaking engagements or promotional events or anything coming up in your very short list in the near future?
You know, I don't think I do, Howard. I'm stuck slaving away for my wonderful clients next couple months, according to my calendar. I've got a couple things that are taking some time, and then who knows after that. But if I stumble on to a speaking opportunity, I'll definitely let you know about it.
Okay. So we've got a couple of shows coming up in the very near future, one of which is The Art of Balance, which originated from or was inspired by my attendance at a Crew LA conference that really has to do with how women in commercial real estate balance their professional lives with that of raising a family, and we've got some wonderful guests on that show. We also have a show coming up in 2 weeks that relates to the employment market and how that has changed. Last time we've done a show was a year and a half ago. So we will be having a couple of guests, including Bob Poline, who's been in the business for about 40 years, talking about what's going on in commercial real estate and employment in commercial real estate. So with that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to really thank you for joining us for this show. I think I'd like to do another show on this topic. And you guys just did a great job. My head's kind of spinning. I think this is a perfect example of no matter how long you've been in the business, you could always learn from someone else, because you guys really have helped me, and so that maybe now, if I'm fortunate enough, I'll be able to discuss these issues competently with Ira if I should be on the other side of a negotiation. So, gentlemen, let's close the show and let's take the show away.
Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Every live and recorded broadcast is accessible on your desktop, tablet, or smartphone at creradio.com. Here's how to reach us with your questions, feedback, and show topics you'd like to hear about. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @CREradio, via email to questions@CREradio.com, or call in during the live show at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our listeners. Howard and his guests' conversations specifically do not offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, please consult your own attorney. Portions of this show may have been pre-recorded. Unauthorized editing or copying of this show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
All right, everyone. That's a wrap.